in the ocean. This is Erebos, the master told me. The sea is strong about it, with strange tides and perilous currents. There are no landing places on this side, and we must not venture too close. We must round the northern headland. There is a small cove amid the western cliffs, entered only through a sea cavern. It is there that the treasure lies. We tack northward, slowly and deviously against the wind, at a distance of 3 or 4 bow shots from the island. All our sea craft was required to make progress, for the wind strengthened wildly as if swollen by the breath of devils. Above its howling, we heard the surf clamor upon those monstrous rocks that rose bare and gaunt from cerements of foam. The isle is unpeopled, said Miarlamidi. It is shunned by sailors and even by the seafowl. Men say that the curse of the maritime gods was laid upon it long ago, forbidding it to any but the creatures of the submarine deep. Its coves and caverns are haunted by crabs and octopi, and perhaps by stranger things. We sailed on in a tedious serpentine course, beaten back at times or borne perilously shoreward by the shifting gusts that opposed us like evil demons. The sun climbed in the orient, shining starkly down on the desolation of crags and scarps that was Erebos. Still we tacked and veered, and I seemed to sense the beginning of a strange unease in the master. But of this, if such there was, his manner betrayed no sign. It was almost noon when we rounded at last the long beak of the northern promontory. There, when we turned southerly, the wind fell in a weird stillness, and the sea was miraculously calmed as if by wizard oils. Our sail hung limp and useless above mirror-like waters, in which it seemed that the boat's reflected image and ours, unbroken, moveless, might float forever amid the unchanging reflection of the monster-shapen isle. We both began to ply the oars, but even thus the boat crawled with a singular slowness. I observed the isle strictly as we passed along, noting several inlets where, to all appearance, a vessel could have landed readily. There is much danger here, said Miarlamidi without elucidating his statement. Again, as we continued, the cliff became a wall that was broken only by rifts and chasms. They were crowned in places by a sparse, funeral-colored vegetation that hardly served to soften their formidable aspect. High up in the clefted rocks, where it seemed that no natural tide or tempest could have flung them, I observed the scattered spars and timbers of antique vessels. Row closer, enjoined the master. We are nearing the cavern that leads to the hidden inlet. Even as we veered landward through the crystalline calm, there was a sudden seething and rippling about us, as if some monster had risen beneath. The boat began to shoot with plummet-like speed toward the cliff, the sea foaming and streaming all around us as though some kraken were dragging us to its caverned lair. Borne like a leaf on a cataract, we toiled vainly with straining oars against the ineluctable current. Heaving higher momentarily, the cliff seemed to shear the heavens above us, unscalable without ledge or foothold. Then in the sheer wall appeared the low, broad arch of a cavern mouth that we had not discerned heretofore, toward which the boat was drawn with dreadful swiftness. It is the entrance, cried the master, but some wizard tide has flooded it. We shipped our useless oars and crouched down behind the thwarts as we neared the opening, for it seemed that the lowness of the arch would afford bare passage to our high-built prow. There was no time to unstep the mast, which broke instantly like a reed as we raced on without slackening into blind, torrential darkness. Half stunned and striving to extricate myself from the fallen, far-weighted sail, I felt the chillness of water splashing about me and knew that the boat was filling and sinking. A moment more, and the water was in my ears and eyes and nostrils, but even as I sank and drowned, there was still a sense of swift onward motion. Then it seemed dimly that arms were around me in the strangling darkness, and I rose suddenly, choking and gasping and spewing, into sunlight. When I had rid my lungs of brine and regained my senses more fully, I found that Mila Lumavi and I were floating in a small haven, shaped like a half moon and surrounded by crags and pinnacles of sullen-colored rock. Close by, in a sheer straight wall, was the inner mouth of the cavern through which the mysterious current had carried us, with faint ripples spreading around it and fading away into water smooth and green as a platter of jade. Opposite, on the haven's farther side, was the long curve of a shelving beach strewn with boulders and driftwood. A boat resembling ours, with an unshipped mast and a furled sail the color of fresh blood, was moored to the beach. Near it, from the shoaling water, protruded the broken-off mast of another boat, whose sunken outlines were discerned obscurely. Two objects, which we took for human figures, were lying half in and half out of the shallows a little farther along the strand. At that distance, we could hardly know whether they were living men or cadavers. Their contours were half hidden by what seemed a curious sort of brownish-yellow drapery that trailed away amid the rocks, appearing to move and shift and waver incessantly. "There is mystery here," said Mihir Lumavi in a low voice. "We must proceed with care and circumspection." We swam ashore at the near end of the beach, where it narrowed like the tip of a crescent moon to meet the seawall. Taking his arthame from its sheath, the master wiped it dry with the hem of his cloak, bidding me do likewise with my own weapon, lest the brine corrode it. Then, hiding the wizard blades beneath our raiment, we followed the broadening beach toward the moored boat and the two reclining figures. "This is indeed the place of Ambar's Chark," observed the master. "The boat with the blood-red sail belongs to Sarkhan. No doubt he has found the cave, which lies hidden somewhere among the rocks. But who are these others? I do not think that they came with Sarkhan." As we neared the figures, the appearance of a yellowish-brown drapery that covered them resolved itself in its true nature. It consisted of a great number of crabs who were crawling over their half-submerged bodies and running to and fro behind a heap of immense boulders. We went forward and stooped over the bodies, from which the crabs were busily detaching morsels of bloody flesh.